Our scripture reading for this morning comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 13, verses 24 through 30. Throughout the Gospel, we hear Jesus speaking in the form of parables. In this reading, Jesus uses that form again to teach us something about the persistence of evil in our world. He put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in their field. But while everybody slept, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, "Master, did you not plant good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." The slaves said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" But he replied, "No. For in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at the harvest time, I will tell the reapers, 'Collect the weeds first, bind them into bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" The word of God. Thanks be to God.
Oh, good morning. My name's Paul Perez. I'm a deacon in the Michigan Conference and serve on conference staff as Associate Director for Mission and Ministry, which is to say I'm a church bureaucrat. So I'm thankful for the invitation to get out of the office and be here this morning to robe up. It's always nice to wear the liturgical green and white on a Sunday with pride. But seriously, I would thank you for the invitation. Thanks to Dale and Aline for the invitation to be here. I serve as director of the JFON Michigan board, the chair of that board of directors, and on behalf of JFON Michigan and Michigan Conference, thank you to Central United Methodist Church for your continued support and hosting of the JFON office here in Traverse City. Also, personally want to say congratulations and thank you. I know that you've recently become a reconciling congregation after a long journey. Now more than ever in this moment in our denomination's life, it's important for congregations to proclaim that they are communities that are welcome, loving, compassionate, and just for all people. Thank you for your witness in this community and in this state. Please pray with me. God, may the words of my mouth and meditations of all of our hearts be found acceptable in your sight, O Lord, who is our rock and our Redeemer. Amen. As a teenager, my family moved to a neighboring suburb, and to be honest, it was a bit of an upgrade. We got a bigger house. I had a bedroom all to myself for the first time, and the community we lived to was a bit more prestigious than the last. The first spring in the new house, my parents went to work on the landscaping. They had briefly owned a lawn care business and were eager to roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty at their new home. They attacked the flower beds in the backyard first, weeding and yanking and pulling and uprooting. About halfway through the cleanup job, the neighbors, who had obviously been observing the new arrivals with keen interest, came over to gently inform my parents that they were yanking out beautiful flowers. I heard this story secondhand from my parents. They admitted to themselves more than me that they really had no idea what they were removing from the flower bed. Wondering out loud what the neighbors must have thought of them. I think it's a wonder they often had that as a German, Irish, and Mexican couple in a predominantly white suburb. And then with an edge of defiance, my mother, now of blessed memory, who in life was rarely ever wrong, said, "Well, we didn't want those plants there anyway." Perhaps there's no better definition for the weed than that, a plant we didn't want there anyway. A foreign invader for some, an unknown, unidentifiable, unrecognizable species for others, a stubborn, persistent nuisance for many. In the parable read this morning, Jesus, according to Matthew's unique reporting, spins a tale of weeds mixed among the wheat and a debate between owner and servants about how to best deal with this rogue vegetation. Pull them out or let them live? Hostility or hospitality? Across the centuries, commentators and preachers repeatedly identify this offending weed as a plant called darnel. A plant who, upon bursting from the soil, so closely resembles the blades of wheat growing nearby that it is able to hide its presence and entangle its roots with its neighbors. By the time it is found out for what it is and named weed, it's too late. Any yanking risk uprooting both weed and wheat. Have you ever felt like darnel? Maybe found a new home but felt like you were under the microscope with the new neighbors trying to decide if you belonged? Or maybe lived your whole life somewhere, put down roots, grew up, but all the time feeling like you didn't quite fit in, felt like you were hiding in plain sight, waiting for someone to find you out, waiting to be plucked up or pulled out. Have you ever felt like a weed? I have. I really sympathize with darnel, belonging and not belonging, being identified as a foreign invader in soil that you call home, of passing under the radar until being called out. Two personal stories. When it came time to start seventh grade, I moved to a new middle school and didn't know many of the students. In fact, just knew a handful of people, and I really glommed on to one boy who we rode the bus together in the morning, and he had many of my classes. But about halfway through the school year, he became really fixated on my Mexican heritage. When the teacher wasn't looking, he started spitting on me during class. He called me spick and wetback and told me to go back where I had come from, even though I had been born in Michigan and grown up just a few miles from where he lived. I thought he was a friend. Fast forward, when I moved into my new house 6 years ago with my family, I soon discovered that there was an older neighbor that liked to walk up and down the block and survey everyone's home and landscaping. Perhaps you know someone like this in your neighborhood. Maybe you might be that person. I mean, it's okay. No judgment. One day he stopped and struck up a conversation, asking me almost immediately, "Where are you from?" I've gotten that question a lot during my life, and depending on how gracious or snarky I'm feeling, I answer it several different ways. I was feeling snarky that day, and I said, "Well, I grew up just a few miles from here." "Well, no, really, where are you from?" And so I broke down and said, "Well, my dad is Mexican, and my mom is German, Irish, and Dutch." And I noticed that he had a rather thick accent himself, and I said, "Well, where are you from?" And he was taken aback. He said, "Well, my wife and I are Slovakia." I said, "Well, what a coincidence. My wife's family is from Slovakia and Poland as well." And he looked at me and he said, "What does that make your children?" Then I said, "Beautiful." And he said, "Well, at least our children are white." Even though I live now just a few miles from where I grew up, these interactions are reminders that for some of my neighbors, I don't belong. I'm a weed among wheat. The El Paso shooting in early August was particularly disturbing for me and my family, who that very same day were out buying school supplies like the Mexican families who were targeted in El Paso. It could have been us is all that went through my mind for several days following. Being a member of a targeted racial ethnic group is frightening. It is a reminder that as a person of color, there are still those who see my life as having less value than their own, and that view me no matter how long I've been here or how long my family's been here, longer than Texas has been around, to be in fact, as a perpetual foreigner. We live in an increasingly harsh and hostile world, one that evermore seems to be succumbing to the temptation faced by the servants in Jesus' parable to label, to pass judgment, to round up, to pull up, yank out, destroy, especially when it comes to immigration. For a decade, I've been a part of Justice for Our Neighbors' work here in Michigan, first as founding director of the Metro Detroit location and now as a board member. While I have some empathy for what it feels like to be labeled and treated like an outsider, the privilege of being a citizen, of receiving a high-quality education, of benefiting from a good-paying job, make it difficult to imagine the daily stress and pressure felt by migrants in this country or migrants who are traveling to this country. After a decade, I can really tell you that it's the worst it's ever been. We are living in a time of unprecedented human migration. The 21st century, I believe, will be the century of the migrant. At the turn of the century, more people were on the move than any other time in recorded human history. Some facts and figures. Today, there is an estimate. It's estimated that about 244 million people are international migrants, that is, moving across national borders, and that another 766 million people are internal migrants, that is, moving within national borders. That's over 1 billion people on the move, an increase of 50% since 2000. The causes are complex, combinations of political, economic, and environmental instability causes people to move, to migrate. As governments make it harder for quote-unquote legal migration across borders, the percentage of people who are undocumented, non-status, or irregular migrants is rising and will continue to rise. It is estimated that non-status migrants comprise about 15 to 20% of the total U.S. population. Community leaders, political activists, and academics are all raising the question about what that means for a liberal democracy based on institutions of representation, legal equality, and citizenship when such a large and growing segment of the population cannot vote and don't have the same legal rights. People are not only moving across borders but within countries due to the demands of a global economy. We commonly don't think of these folks as migrants, but they are undoubtedly people on the move. Demographers who study the U.S. Census, more facts and figures, tell us that every 5 years, 15% of our population is moving and that at least 10% move one county away. The migrants tend to be younger, roughly a third, 18 to 35 years, and will be among that 15% of folks that move. Few communities here in Michigan, let alone the U.S., will be untouched by the century of the migrant, either in receiving or sending people or both. The hard work of attracting community members will become increasingly less fruitful as new members stay for just a while and then move on. Community will increasingly be defined as much by Main Street and neighborhood as the virtual corridors of the digital commons. The century of the migrant will undoubtedly change the way we live, work, play, make decisions together, even worship together. Hello, Facebook friends. Challenging the assumptions of our basic institutions. What is at issue today is that we are using a 20th century approach to a 21st century reality. We are using a militarized solution to address a global humanitarian challenge. We are resorting to practices grounded in surveillance, criminalization, punishment, and incarceration instead of care, compassion, healing, and integration. We are attempting to make it more difficult to enter this country, not just through physical barriers built on the border, but by what migrant advocates are calling an invisible wall that is undermining long-standing legal pathways for refugees and asylum seekers making once routine cases cumbersome and time-consuming. All this makes it more difficult, if not impossible, for many people to enter the U.S. and secure status. I'm often asked, Paul, why don't people just get in line and do it the right way, like my ancestors did? My response, the line, if it really ever existed at Ellis Island, is like that island, a thing of the past, a relic of a bygone era. Today, immigration law is as complex, if not more complex, than the U.S. tax code. Created piecemeal over the decades, it's not internally consistent. What works for one case does not always work for a similar one. My response is, there is no one line. There is many lines as there are people wishing to enter the U.S. And over the past 3 years, the invisible wall has made those lines obstacle courses with often insurmountable barriers. My response, this is why people, many fleeing their lives and seeking safety and refuge in the U.S., are willing to take the risk to enter illegally. Migrants are survivors, tough and tenacious people whose seeds of hope can weather the test of time, who are willing to put down roots in difficult and often inhospitable places. Last year, I traveled to the southern border to learn and to listen to community leaders in the wake of zero tolerance policy that was instituted by our administration there along the southern border. While I was there, I met two women. I'll call them Maria and Shalom. Maria and her family were camped out on the Mexican side of the border. They had made the long and arduous journey from one of the northern triangle countries in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. These countries are among some of the most dangerous places in the world, where a perfect storm of government corruption, organized crime, and young people with military training kind of come together. Maria's family survived this situation. One of their children had been abducted by a criminal organization. Their friends and family banded together and raised the resources to pay the ransom in order to get that child back. But just a short time later, another child was abducted, and this time they didn't have the resources. That child was murdered in front of her family. Shalom was a young woman who came from a country in Africa, a community organizer and political activist who found herself on the losing side of a contested election. She was harassed by government officials and security forces, ultimately being both physically and sexually assaulted. Her mother pled with her, leave. Don't take your children, leave them here. It's the only chance for both of you, all of you, to survive. And so she got on a plane and through a circuitous pathway I don't think I'll ever understand. First she went to South Africa and they sort of pushed her on. Then she went to Ireland and finally she landed in the U.S. And while talking with Shalom, I said, what do you want people to know? And she said, I want people to know that I didn't even want to come here. I don't want to be in the United States. I'm not here to steal anyone's job. I'm fleeing for my life. She found refuge at a nonprofit organization run by a Catholic order called La Posada Providencia. And while she was a resident there, she found out she was pregnant, holding her infant son. I said, Shalom, what gets you through this? And she said, God. I feel like God has been with me each step of the way, at every turn. God has been with me. And it's then that I understood why she named her small child Emmanuel, God with us. Unfortunately, after the Supreme Court ruling earlier this month, people who have similar experiences like Shalom and Maria wouldn't even be able to set foot in the U.S. They'd have to stay in the country where they first arrived, waiting for their asylum case to be processed. The 20th century response to a 21st century challenge is not working. In fact, it's harming people and harming this nation. We have succumbed to the temptation goaded to choose hostility over hospitality. This is the work of that old enemy that haunts the U.S., racism, that recruits and enlists us to label the wheat and the weeds, the wanted and the unwanted, those who belong and those don't, the permanently innocent and the permanently guilty, those who are white and everyone else, to pluck up, to yank out, to tear apart. Who is the U.S. becoming as a nation? Are we plucking out our deepest values, yanking the promise of democracy, tearing apart the soul of a nation? What if we took Jesus' parable to heart? Jesus' parable reminds us that there is no shame in being a weed. Weeds are survivors, tenacious, stubborn plants whose seeds can lay dormant for decades, who can take root in the most difficult of soils, who are integral part of ecology, protecting soil from water and wind erosion and the scorching sun. Jesus' parable teaches us that the seeds of discord, that the hostile one, the enemy plants, are not in the field, but in hearts and minds of the servants of us, providing the invitation, nay, the temptation to resort to plucking and yanking and pulling, to resort to harmful destruction. Jesus' parable urges compassion. Instead of yanking weeds, the owner counsels patience, restraint. Let's wait until the harvest. A live and let live policy. The owner is willing to abandon careful prevention efforts, to take a risk of letting the wheats and weeds live together, to minimize harm and avoid destruction so that all might survive. All might thrive. Likewise, the owner's final judgment is not about the wheat rejoicing in their separation from the weeds and basking in the satisfaction that their neighbors are finally getting the punishment they deserve, burned up and destroyed in the fire. In fact, it's not a final judgment at all. It's a harvest. Both the wheat and the weeds are cut and gathered in and head on to the next step in the process. The weeds are disposed by burning, and the wheat enters its next stage. I mean, it's taken and beaten on the thrashing floor. Grain separated from chaff. The chaff, like the weeds, are burned. The grain is milled and crushed, and it may then find itself mixed and kneaded, leavened, and baked. That is, exposed to the flames of the oven before perhaps it's blessed and broken, shared and consumed at a table or an altar. Ultimately, neither weed nor wheat are spared the blade or the flame. The blade and flame are not destructive tools, but transformative tools of the cultivation process. Jesus' parable proclaims that the God of the Scriptures, the God of Abraham and Sarah, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, the prophets, the God of Jesus, of Mary and Martha, of Peter and Paul, is no enemy to weeds, but a compassionate protector of the widow, the orphan, and the migrant, the liberator of slave who guides our refugee people through the wilderness, the Holy One who opens the temple to migrant and eunuch alike, the one who is enfleshed in an itinerant rabbi who delights in confronting the authorities, eating with sinners and tax collectors, and even healing on the Sabbath. Jesus' parable proclaims compassion over cruelty, hospitality over hostility, life over destruction. It is a compassion that stops harm in its tracks, a compassion that chooses nurture and growth, a compassion that imagines a time when the debates of the field will give way to the celebration of the bountiful harvest. So what if we took this parable seriously? What if we just stopped the harm? What if we chose compassion each and every moment of our lives, personally, communally, nationally? Do we have the courage for such a time as this? As people of faith, isn't this our call? To proclaim in word and action the gracious and expansive compassion of God that abhors destruction, who lovingly fosters life and growth, who promises a bountiful harvest of love, justice, and peace? What would this proclamation look like in the face of the century of the migrant? Stopping harmful practices of criminalization, detention, and deportation? Adopting a humanitarian approach, especially at the southern border? Addressing the root causes, I mean pun intended, of political, economic, ecological, and the U.S. role in those causes? Building local communities that are responsive and resilient to migration, that welcome and integrate new members and bless and send current ones? I know I'm preaching a bit to the choir. You have let the seeds of compassion take root here in the form of legal aid that Justice for Our Neighbors offers. But more than that, JFON also offers a place of hospitality in the face of hostility, dedicating to treating each and every client with the dignity they deserve. JFON does its part to be a force for compassion in an increasingly cruel world, no matter how small or futile it may seem at times. Again, on behalf of the JFON Michigan Board of Directors and the Michigan Conference, I thank you for letting JFON spring up and grow here in Traverse City. I encourage you to continue to let compassion grow, to be as stubborn and tenacious as weeds, to let your roots entwine in this community, to do your part no matter how small or futile it may seem sometimes, to not only dig deep to share your time, talents, and treasures and to make JFON's September campaign a success, but to always choose hospitality over hostility, to be a force of compassion for such a time as this.